thousands.
So the House Committee on Health Care to order.
I'm not using sports analogies.
We have a quorum, Madam Minister. Open a work session. If we have a quorum, right?
Yes.
Opening a work session for the purpose of introducing a couple of committee bills. Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 3285, dated February 3rd, 2015, and LC 3464, dated February 4th, 2015.
Thank you, Representative Nose. Representative Nose moves that we introduce as committee bills LC 3285, dated 2315, and LC 3464, dated 2415. I'll remind the committee that introducing an LC as a committee bill in no way endorses that, nor does it should want to infer that any individual that votes for the introduction is prepared to vote yes or no on the bill. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the introduction of the two bills as committee bills? So moved. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2234, please. Madam Minister, would you call the first panel?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Gene Whitsitt, Representative Brent Barton, and Senator Sarah Gelser, please. And while they're coming up, I'll just quickly give you a
sentence.
Please
tell us what we're here for.
House Bill 2234 requires the Oregon Health Authority and insurers to reimburse the cost of physician services and or to create billing codes or alternative mechanism to enable community assessment centers to bill for child abuse medical assessments and related services.
Colleagues, go for it.
Start off. How should we start? I'll start. Yeah, because I don't have visuals. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and honorable colleagues. Thank you for hearing this important bill and a very essential bill. Oregon established an evidence-based model in 2009 in order to ensure that the best possible support for children suffering from abuse. This bill is really simple. All we're asking for is to be paid for the services being provided to these children. The bill was introduced as a result of meeting pre-session filing deadline, and we've done some amendments. I think you have an amendment, Mr. Chair, before you to clarify that we're just looking. The hospitals have come back and talked about that they thought it was covered, but we need assurances that this is going to be coded or paid for. Over 75% or more children use centers like Liberty House here in Salem, Kids Center in Bend, Oregon. It's a result of the statute that Senator is going to talk about, Carley's Law. 75% or more of the children our centers see are Medicaid eligible. So there's not a huge impact on private health plans, but it's a large positive impact on children's lives. Approximately 6,000 children identified or listed who might be covered by this situation. So again, it's not a large number of children, but without intervention, their lives and potential could be drastically bad. Without intervention, these kids will learn to dramatically lower costs down the road. Other expenses to these children are not saved. So this is a cost savings bill. The amended version of the bill leaves enough flexibility for OHA to work with stakeholders to find a solution to the issue, ensuring that children in crisis situations get the proper evaluation, care, and follow-up. We're also ensuring that the judicial system has the proper information available to make sure the abusers are fully prosecuted and kept away from these children. I spent years on the Deschutes County and State Commission on Children and Family, and I can tell you two things. Child abuse unchecked leads to a lifetime of challenges and a pattern that carries on from generation to generation. I recently visited Ben's Child Abuse Intervention Center, the Kids Center, before the session began, and they reported this bill is very important to them, and I urge this committee to pass this bill as soon as possible. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we wait for the panel and last questions at the end. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members. Welcome home.
Thank you. It feels good to be home. I miss you. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis, Albany, Philomath, Tangent, Millersburg, and unincorporated areas of Lynn and Benton County and Philomath. I'm very pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 2234. And my purpose for sitting before you is to take you back in time a little bit to remind you of what this bill is about, why these assessments are so important, and why they are medically necessary and appropriately covered by medical insurance and the Oregon Health Plan. In 2005, there was a tragic situation in my community. A beautiful little girl named Carly Sheehan died. She died after she was tortured and abused by her mother's boyfriend. What made this death even more tragic was that she had been referred to child welfare three times in the year leading up to her death, and those incidents were unsubstantiated. With apologies to Sandy, because I'm still learning the technology over on the Senate side in terms of how our printer works, so I brought some photographs to tell you the story of why these assessments save lives. Remember that Carly died in June. In December of that year, Carly was with her dad and was making visits.
Remember the prior year.
In December of the prior year, in December of 2004, David Sheehan, who gave me permission to use these photos today, I spoke with him this morning, prepared Carly to go for the weekend to visit her mother. You have up there this photograph of Carly on Friday afternoon.
It's coming.
Yes. Okay, it will
we
be coming.
We didn't have enough.
So there's this photograph of Carly, and what I like to notice about this photograph that's so very important is her beautiful hair. She has a lot of beautiful blonde hair. Before Carly came home at the end of the weekend, David got a phone call that said, Carly isn't feeling very well. She doesn't look so good. This is what Carly looked like when she came back at the end of the weekend.
You'll see she didn't
want to let go of her dad. You'll see she's missing a lot of that beautiful hair that she had just days before, and her body and her head was completely covered with these bruises. They're devastating photos. David was terrified and worried. He called the police. He called the child welfare worker who had previously done an abuse investigation, and he called his neighbor who was a nurse. Law enforcement officer came out, went and talked to the mom and the boyfriend, and they said she did it to herself. The law enforcement officer said that that seemed consistent with the story. They called the DHS child welfare worker, and they said that it could wait until Monday. The nurse said, you need to take pictures of this. On Monday, when David still didn't get a call back, he physically took Carly to the child welfare office along with these photographs. Those photographs were then lost and never seen again until the trial for her murder. Carly did not have the benefit of a child abuse medical examination. At the trial, Dr. Carol Shervinek, who is the medical director of ABC House in Albany, testified that had she seen this child, she could have told you in that very first moment that this was a child that was a victim of child abuse, that a two-year-old, she's 2 years old in this picture, a two-year-old cannot inflict that type of self-injury on herself. If Carly had had the benefit of a child abuse medical assessment in December of 2004, she would have turned 13 last month. And many of us in Corvallis ate cookies that were purchased at a downtown bakery also in Portland and in Dublin, Ireland to celebrate her her birthday. But we didn't have those child abuse medical assessments. So after her killer was convicted, we introduced House Bill, ironically, 3324. Now we're at House Bill 2234, that required child abuse medical assessments whenever there is a case of a suspicious physical injury. We very clearly defined what a suspicious physical injury is. And just to remind you, so you know what we are asking these plans to cover, suspicious physical injuries include but are not limited to burns or scalds, excessive bruising or abrasions on any part of the body, bruising, swelling, or abrasions on the head, neck, or face, fractures of any bone in a child under the age of 3, multiple fractures in a child of any age, dislocation, soft tissue swelling, or moderate to severe cuts, loss of the ability to walk or move normally according to the child's developmental ability, unconsciousness or difficulty maintaining consciousness, multiple injuries of different types, injuries causing serious or protracted disfigurement or loss of impairment of the function of any bodily organ, and any other injury that threatens the physical well-being of the child. Just like Carly, we are talking about a very serious situation that requires medical attention and would be appropriately covered by medical insurance. The burden to our extraordinary child abuse assessment centers has been enormous in carrying out the work that has been required by this law. In the first year after Carly's law went into effect, the number of child abuse medical assessments increased by over 175%. Carly's law did not cause a whole bunch of children to become injured. What Carly's law did was shine a spotlight on all of the kids that we were missing that have fallen through the cracks. And what the assessment centers have told me, and district attorneys and child welfare workers, is that Carly's law has saved lives of Oregon children. Other states are now looking at implementing this law in municipalities, and it's going to have a positive impact in other places as well. And I like to think that that is Carly's legacy, because her father has been so willing to be so open about what happened to Carly. In order to continue this work, we have to be able to pay for these assessments. To me, it only makes sense that the Oregon Health Authority and our private insurers would cover these exams. These are medically necessary, they save lives, and helping kids like Carly, responding and making sure that when you come home from a weekend and you look like this, you have access to a doctor that has the expertise to be able to help you with both your physical, emotional, and family needs. It isn't just a medical necessity, it's a moral imperative. I hope that you'll join me in supporting House Bill 2234. It's critically important, and you can know it's something we can do today to keep kids safe and help these centers do the extraordinary work that they do every day for truly the most vulnerable children in our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich, and members of the committee. It's taken me three terms to actually finally appear in front of this committee. I spend a good portion of my legislative time and energy working on issues related to child abuse. Those issues typically, the vast majority, end up in front of the Judiciary Committee, so I'm delighted to be here. Of the issues I'd say that we work on, there's, you know, the spectrum, there's a variety of issues that my colleagues and I have worked on together involving child abuse prevention. And then, of course, there's a lot of issues that come before this body involving after the fact, kind of ex post, what we do in child abuse in terms of the criminal prosecution, criminal sentencing. In this case, it's the community assessment and how that is built. Now, you know, each of us, I suppose, the word hero is used fairly often in political discourse. It's typically used in, say, the military context, law enforcement, public safety context. But each of us know, you know, each of us have a picture in our heads of what that might mean. And for me, when I think of heroes, I really think of the courageous children who are able to say enough, are able to just find that courage inside of themselves to tip off what they're doing, perhaps to an adult, to a teacher, a friend. And when that happens, when they're able to find that inner strength, it doesn't always happen, but when they can, kind of the first step in that process, they're going to end up in what's called a community assessment center. There are 21 in the state of Oregon. And these are specialized centers. They're not just like any other medical clinic, and that's why we're arguing that they should have their own billing system. They are very compassionate. They have the specialized medical expertise to do the necessary forensic examination. But they also have the expertise to prepare evidence, to talk to the children in ways that could later assist in law enforcement investigation and potentially be admissible in court. That is something that's specialized skill. That is different than just the traditional medical practice. And when a child goes into the center, in my district in Clackamas County, the children would go to a place called the Children's Center. And most children in Multnomah County would go through a program called CARES Northwest. I believe in Lane County as well, they go through a program called CARES Northwest. It's different in Salem, it's different in Benton. There are 21 around the state. And at least in my district, every child who goes in for this process, which is every bit as bad as it sounds, they try and make it as gentle as possible, but it is indeed a forensic process. There's no way around that. And every child, to give some sense of stability as they go through this process, is given a blanket that they can wrap themselves in and a bear. And so after a number of years of working on this issue and volunteering with the Children's Center, they once gave me a bear and a blanket, which I actually keep in my legislative office. If any of you guys ever swing by my office, you'll note this bear and this blanket sitting there. And I bring it here because, first of all, it's perhaps on a personal level, it means as much as any gift I've received in many years to me. It just means a lot. And second of all, this bear, I kind of think... this bear is all of us. This bear is what helps this child get through that process. It's kind of that manifestation that they can literally clutch onto. But really, it is all of us. It is the people of Oregon and our commitment to shepherding children when they're able to come forward into a place of safety and doing as best we can. That is the unique role that these community assessment centers play in this state. It is, again, a unique skill set, and I think it is reasonable then to have a unique billing code for that purpose. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have an amendment coming, is that right?
Yes. There's a dash
one. That's what's holding up. No, that'll be.
Yes. Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
The dash one, the hospitals have come forth and trying, they want to work on this. They thought that they could do it without the billing code. And that's still to be worked out, whether we actually need a billing code or they can do it. I don't care what comes out. We just need it paid for, because as you've heard, the committee's heard, it's we need to keep this going, and we need to fund it so they can provide this invaluable service to these special children.
Well, let's not waste a lot of time.
So they're working together with the supporters to try to come up with exactly where there'll be a billing code or how they're going to pay it, but we want to be confirmed by them that they will pay for it.
Good. Representative Buehler?
Yeah, Chair. That was one of my – I'm very supportive, but my concept is that insurers don't create billing codes for medical services. That's a federal designation. So is that what you're talking
about? Yes, sir. Mr. Chair and Representative Buehler, the hospitals are saying that it's a contract. You have to contract with the hospitals to do that. And to set up to create the billing codes to do this. But I've the people sponsoring this, Doug Riggs was the one that brought it to me, and they're working out a solution so we'll be able to pay for it. Last time I talked, you're going to get better testimony as far as where we are, we want to. Some way solution to come up between the billing, how we bill it, or how we get reimbursed before next February, if not sooner.
No, let's get this in this session. Get folks to work on it. Move it. Senator Hayden.
Chair Greenlick, thank you. Very, very supportive. Hope we can move this through quickly so we can get a satisfactory result. Have more of an informational question for me. I want to make sure that this doesn't take away from any services somewhere else that kind of do the same thing, to where if you got a billing code that would qualify in one area, that it would reduce over here. I'm not feeling that, but I would make sure that, you know, with their physician or wherever they are getting the limited services that they can now, that it doesn't limit that in any way.
I can comment briefly, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden. I guess there is a billing code for the medical part, but not the forensic examination, which takes a long time, and that's what they're trying to work out. And I'm not an expert in this.
Other questions? Okay, guys, thank you very much. We'll have more testimony. While we're calling the next panel up, I really would urge my colleagues, if you've not visited one of these centers, to try and take the opportunity to do it. It's a very moving and emotional experience. And Administrator, will you call the next panel, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Allison Kelly, Barbara Bechera, Kevin Dowling, and...
That's three at a time.
Yeah. And then we have Doug in it.
I'll ask you to be brief, please. We have a lot of activity today, but make sure you tell the story.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing us today on this bill. My name is Allison Kelly, and I serve as the Chief Executive Officer of Liberty House, which is the Child Abuse Assessment Center located here in Salem. We are happy to have you come visit anytime. I did submit written testimony yesterday, as well as an informational handout. I've given you paper copies. So you'll see a letter from me. You'll see an informational document on behalf of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Assessment Centers. As you've heard, there are 21 of these. Also today, we have submitted some information produced by the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs that does a nice job of explaining the results of the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study that basically explains that the more adverse experience children have in childhood, the longer and more expensive their health care and mental health needs are later. I also brought with me today a letter to you from the District Attorney of Marion County, Walt Biglock, in support of this. I want to make three brief points and would be happy to take any questions. First point is that although we heard from Senator Gelzer about what happened with Carly in 2005, I would like you to understand today that child abuse continues to be a huge problem. In September of 2013, the National Science Foundation came out with a study calling it a public health epidemic and calling for a nationally coordinated solution. And my second point is that in Oregon, ORS 418747 gives us that coordinated local solution, those county multidisciplinary teams that work, and our centers are part of those teams. That strategy, though, is underfunded, and it's unsustainably underfunded. So the three core services that we provide, the medical assessment, the forensic interview, and the family support, for example, at Liberty House, we don't throw a full meal deal at every child. We only will provide what that child needs. So if they don't need a medical checkup, but they need a forensic interview, we'll provide it, but we can't bill for it. And just to correct this, you heard in the Dash 1 amendments, the new language will ensure that the costs are billable and reimbursable. We understand that the codes exist and are billable in Oregon for those medical assessments. There are codes that exist for the forensic interviews, and from the best of our research, they're only funded in North Dakota. There are no RVUs, relative value units, assigned in Oregon. They're not above the line for the Oregon Health Plan. So we want that 99499 code above the line and billable and reimbursable in Oregon. And it would help. Those interviews are crucial in stopping the abuse and helping victims recover and live productive lives. The National Science Foundation said that aggregate lifetime expense is over $250,000 per child. And that shows up in all the associated expenses, plus the cancer, heart disease, diabetes, chronic disease, and the mental and emotional health issues. So the last point that I want to make, in addition just to saying thank you very much for hearing us on this, is that I do not want to sugarcoat the severity of the abuse that we are seeing on the front lines. At my center alone, we are seeing week after week infants and toddlers who are still suffering unthinkable beatings, children who have been forcibly sexually assaulted, and children who have been forced to watch, young children, forced to watch adult material on tablets because of the easy accessibility to the internet, and then forced to perform very adult acts on people who are bigger and stronger. These children are little. They can't defend themselves. They tell us that they can't get those images out of their little minds. And I believe the onslaught of abuse will, if unchecked, undermine all that the state of Oregon is trying to accomplish with its early learning and other educational objectives. Your favorable consideration of this bill, as amended, will improve the resources for these critical services and help us help these children. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Next, please.
Dear Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2234 and services dedicated to child abuse victims in Oregon. My name is Kevin Dowling. I work as the manager at CARES Northwest in Portland, Oregon. I'm also the current board chair of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. CARES Northwest is one of the oldest and largest child abuse intervention centers in the country. Last year, we provided medical care to over 1,500 children, not including children seen in the emergency department or children admitted to the hospital for concerns of abuse. I've worked at CARES since 1994, and one of the most compelling studies I've seen over the years is called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACE study, which I referenced in my written testimony. In my experience, people are quick to understand the negative impacts of sex abuse or physical abuse on the child. But what I've appreciated about that ACE study is it highlights how that trauma, if someone doesn't get the help and support that they need, impacts that child's health decades later and is linked to some of the major causes of illness and early death in our society. One thing that had helped me understand that connection was reading about how Dr. Vincent Felitti, one of the main authors of that study, came to make that connection between childhood trauma and adult health. Dr. Felitti was the chief of Kaiser Permanente's preventative medicine department in Southern California in the 1980s. And he was frustrated because his obesity clinic that he was running, over half of the patients were dropping out. And even more frustrating, a lot of the patients that were dropping out were successfully losing weight. And he couldn't figure out why. And so he ended up interviewing hundreds of them, hundreds of the dropouts. And he started by asking them questions that we might expect when we go to our doctors. You know, how much did you weigh when you were born? How much did you weigh when you entered high school? What age were you when you became sexually active? How old were you when you were married? And he wasn't getting any clues. Until one day he was interviewing a woman and he misspoke. And instead of asking at what age were you when you became sexually active, he asked, what weight were you when you became sexually active? Mm. And she said, 40 pounds. And he didn't understand. And so he asked the question again, at what weight were you when you became sexually active? And this time she gave the same answer and broke into tears and said, I was 4 years old. It was my father. And what he found when he started asking the questions a little differently is he ran into similar responses from the patients that he was seeing. And he was struck by how common child sex abuse was among the patients that they served. And what he realized was that the patients didn't see obesity as the problem. They saw it as a solution to the problem. That food was a way to address the anxiety, fear, anger, depression that was associated with the trauma. And it also, for a lot of women, it felt like it protected them, because in their minds it made them invisible to men. And this was a key thing that I learned from that study, that some of the ways that we end up coping with childhood trauma, especially if we find ourselves without the proper help and support, some of those ways of coping, like overeating, alcohol, smoking, drugs, they're actually effective solutions to the problem. Those intrusive thoughts, anxiety, depression. It's just that those solutions have serious side effects that lead to things like diabetes and stroke and heart disease and cancer. And I'm urging you to support House Bill 2234 because I think we have an opportunity in child abuse intervention centers to make a difference, not only to provide care and protection of that child today, but really to make an impact in their well-being into adulthood. House Bill 2234, it fixes a reimbursement system that's, frankly, it's currently out of whack. And it gives us an opportunity to minimize the impact of trauma on the child, on the adult that child will become, and really on all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Greenlick and the rest of the committee members, for this opportunity. I thank you for the work you do to make Oregon a great state, to make it a healthy state, and to make it a great place for our kids. My name is Barbara Pesquiera, and I'm the Executive Director of Children's Center, which is the Child Abuse Intervention Center that serves Clackamas County. We are a nonprofit organization. We formed in 2002, and we've served nearly 4,000 children since then. We are a member of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers, which has proposed the legislation you have before you today. Oregon is fortunate to have a strong network of child abuse intervention centers. While most are freestanding, others are based in hospitals, some are based in DA's office, some serve single counties, others serve multiple. But the child abuse intervention response is available statewide. And what we have in common is our goal to serve children with a safe and child-friendly environment, to assess their health, and to provide them with information that will help the investigators. Most of our centers follow a medical model. We are specialized pediatric clinics. Most of our centers respond to all forms of abuse and neglect, sexual, physical, emotional, and we see victims of sex trafficking. Oregon has more medical models than most states, partly because of Oregon's unique Carley's Law that Senator Gelster talked about earlier. Children's Center, like others across the state, is financially fragile. We appreciate the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention funding that we receive through the criminal fines account, and we receive other local funding. But we rely heavily on generous donations by individuals, business, and foundations across this state to be able to provide a publicly mandated essential service. So at Children's Center, several years ago, we started drilling into medical billing, which at that time was 11% of our revenue. We were challenged to find billing codes that adequately reflect the complexity of the child abuse assessment. We use the same office visit code that for a two-hour exam that general pediatricians use for standard well check visits. The codes place no value on the forensic interview, which directly informs the diagnosis that our pediatrician and nurse practitioners make. Centers across the state are facing the same challenges. The reimbursement is especially low for children who are on Medicaid, which accounts for 76% of our patients statewide. We recoup an average of 22% of what we bill from the Medicaid payers. At Children's Center, we were able to have conversations with our CCOs about the long-term benefits and the value of child abuse assessments and the fact that the reimbursement system is out of whack. We were able to negotiate alternative fee structures for patients covered by CARE Oregon, and that they now pay us a flat fee per patient that's closer to 40% of our costs. We were then able to arrange similar arrangements with Family Care and with Providence's Medicaid plan. Children's Center may have moved closer to a sustainable solution, but it is only partial. The flat rate is still well below the cost of providing an assessment. We still have other Medicaid and commercial carriers to negotiate with, and this takes hours and months. Statewide, we're facing a situation where you have 21 center directors, each negotiating with each of their providers in hopes of achieving sustainability, but working in a vacuum without any consistency. House Bill 2234, as amended, is a smart solution that will provide stability across a public critical health system. It removes the patchwork nature of alternative fee agreements. It boosts the center's ability to see every child who needs our services, regardless of their ability to pay, and to meet the public mandate that we were created to fill. It will provide stability to financially fragile centers. It will save lives. It will rebalance the reimbursement system that's out of whack. So on behalf of the 6,000 children we serve, I thank you for your support for House Bill 2234.
Thank you. Are there questions of the panel? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
You do great work. You're very important to us.
Thank you.
I do.
Could you call the next panel?
Doug Riggs and Elizabeth Remley, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the network, and I want to thank you for taking the time to hear the very moving testimony this morning. I really appreciate the legislator's interest in this. I want to make three quick points. One is we've been overwhelmed by the response to this bill. This is something we started talking about late last fall. It is meant to address a very serious need in the community, and the response from you and your colleagues has been overwhelming. The Oregon Health Authority has been fantastic to work with over the last 2 weeks, and I want to commend them for sitting down and really digging into this. And then we've had many conversations with CCOs, with insurers, with hospitals, and I think that what it's led to is an agreement that we're all on the same page, that all of us want to see these services more adequately funded, and it's just a matter of how we do that. So as you note in the original bill, and Representative Buehler mentioned this, the original bill said create a billing code. Well, that's a red flag right away if you say create a new billing code, because there are very complicated statutes that govern how you create a billing code. As it turned out, we don't think we need to create a new billing code. The Oregon Health Authority has told us that there are existing billing codes that could be used. There are already CPT codes on everybody's list. It's a matter of defining them more carefully, setting a value to that billing code, and being able to apply that if you're a center. But we also recognize that in some cases, maybe a billing code is not the best way to do it in a contract with an insurer. Barbara mentioned some agreements we have with some CCOs that have alternative payment methodologies for these services. And And we are wide open to that idea. So the Dash 1 amendment that Representative Wisnant mentioned is designed to give the OHA the flexibility to be able to adopt a series of directives to solve this in the most effective manner possible. It might be a billing code in some cases. It might be an alternative payment mechanism or something in a contract. But I think the amendment would get the ball rolling and would keep it flexible enough that we could come up with a solution that works for the children and the centers and also for the medical community. So again, I really want to thank you. I want to commend all the people that have been generous with their time the last week in working on this, and I really hope that we can move a bill with the Dash 1 amendments in the next few days and really begin to see an expansion of the level of high-level services to these kids who are in need. Thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Remley, and I'm here today on behalf of Cambia Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield. I concur with Doug that we've had several great conversations about how exactly to deal with this issue and pay for these services. We're working to understand the problem faced by the centers. They play a crucial role in caring for children who have been subjected to unspeakable abuses, and we greatly respect their work. Cambia would like to reimburse these centers for the services they provide to these children. We would like to have high-level conversations between Doug's client and our experts in contracting to discover just how to do this. And in the meantime, we'd like a little bit of time to be able to have those conversations before we move a bill forward so that the bill can reflect what can actually happen in real life. So the legislation and the conceptual amendments both mention codes, and coding is really difficult. Creating a new code is really difficult for a carrier to do, and federal rules actually limit our ability to do that. And so we want to find another way, as Doug mentioned, to be able to do this. So we look forward to chatting with his clients and finding a solution that works for everybody. Thanks.
Yeah, I would suggest take all the time you need as long as it's only a few days. So let's move this thing. And if we need to perfect it in the Senate, we'll perfect it there, but let's get it going.
And hopefully we'll get the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Hopefully we'll get the amendment. And hopefully everybody will be happy with the amendment. Any questions? Thank you very much. Oh. Wait a minute. Sorry.
Just one quick comment.
Go for it.
These kids don't have the pleasure of waiting for when this happens to them. So I concur. We ought to move this.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2234. And I'm going to move the agenda a little bit and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2419, please. Madam Minister, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, first of all, while we're going to call Courtney Wessling from the Oregon Health Authority up to kick off the bill. While she's coming, the bill does multiple things. It modifies the definition of healthcare interpreter and revises the membership of the Oregon Council on healthcare interpreters to include a healthcare interpreter, modifies healthcare data reporting requirements, and multiple other things that she could do a much better job of articulating.
Okay.
Go for it.
Okay. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Hayden and Nose. For the record, my name is Courtney Wessling, Legislative Director for the Oregon Health Authority. This bill, 2419, is a housekeeping bill. That's how we see it. Cleans up some statutes. It aligns some things with current law that aren't currently aligned. So I'm going to walk you through what those are and then talk to you a little bit about the Dash 2 amendment. So first of all, we are going to change Oregon Health Policy and Research references to Oregon Health Authority. This is just cleaning up some outdated references to committees that no longer exist. And it's pretty straightforward. Healthcare interpreter cleanup is the biggest piece, and I'm going to address that in the Dash 2. The law that passed in 2001 left out some critical things, so we're making some adjustments. We're adding a healthcare interpreter to the council, which kind of makes sense, I think, and some new definitions that clear up some confusion. It also eliminates the fees because we found that that's a barrier for folks to be a part of this effort. And then the third piece that we're addressing is removing references to the Blue Mountain Recovery Center, which no longer exists, expanding the qualifications and experience that would qualify someone to be appointed as the state public health officer. Currently, it says that this physician certified by the American Board of Preventive Medicine can be appointed, but it doesn't offer any flexibility beyond that. And then the final two pieces are related to addictions, alcohol and drug evaluation services. We, I want to just let you know that we have, an issue has been raised with us that we need to address in probably another amendment. It kind of messed up the way that we, let me get to my notes. The way it was drafted unintentionally changed the role of DUI treatment providers and alcohol and drug evaluation specialists, so we need to fix that before this goes.
In this bill?
Yeah, that's the hope.
And that's an amendment you don't have yet?
We don't have it yet. It was just brought to our attention. I apologize. The Dash 2 amendment, which is available, adds sign language references throughout the bill. So we have a lot of folks here today, I think, that are pleased with that addition, and they're going to tell you about that. That's another oversight in the past that was not included. So we're going to add that, and then a couple of other pieces that we're changing in the healthcare interpreter piece of the bill. That will remove a requirement to for an internship for qualification, which they aren't able to do, and then a couple of other training requirement technical wording pieces. So that's about it. I'm happy to take questions. I also have smart people behind me that can come up and join me if we have really technical questions. Thank you.
Any questions? We'll have some more testimony on the issue of the signing, I think. Yep. Is that right? Okay, well, let's go with some testimony then. Hang around, huh?
Oh, okay. I'll hang out.
Thank you. Okay. Call the next panel, please.
Helen Eby. Anna Ocampo. And Philip Wolf.
Good afternoon. I'm just organizing my papers here so I can hand some things to you at the right time.
Is somebody else coming up?
I'm the president of the Oregon Society of Translators and Interpreters, and we were pleased to be able to work with the Oregon Health Authority on some of the cleanup for this bill. So one of the things I want to commend them for is the O2 amendment, where they removed the requirement for the internship. That was very, very helpful because I'm also an interpreter trainer, and I had a lot of students come to me asking how they could possibly take care of that requirement since there are no internships available. And requiring the 40 hours that the OHA required as a replacement for the internship, since there were no internships available, was very difficult for a Sinhalese student of mine who got maybe one appointment a month of interpreting. So imagine how long it would take to fulfill that requirement for somebody in Sinhalese. So there are no Sinhalese interpreters on the register. By the time you get 40 hours, it's taken 4 years and you've lost the paperwork. So we're very thankful that they removed that requirement, and now Sinhalese interpreters will be able to be registered as qualified interpreters on the registry. So that was a very practical thing. And then there's some little things like cleaning up language. You know, interpreters don't study medical ethics. They study medical interpreting ethics. We're not doctors. We're interpreters. So that was very helpful. But there's a couple of things that still remain to be discussed. We're also very thankful that they included sign language in the bill, because our colleagues in Washington State, I work very closely with them in many things, and they've told us that there's been a lot of issues with unqualified interpreters interpreting in sign language in medical appointments. I've heard a lot of complaints about that through my colleagues who work with the Washington Interpreters Union. We're not advocating for a union here in Oregon. Don't worry about that. But I work closely with my friends there because as professionals who work in the industry, we talk. And there's been a lot of problems with unqualified healthcare interpreters in sign language. And so it's been a problem. So I'm very glad that that is going to get cleaned up through this. So the other thing that is really a problem here, and it's a small thing, but the very last line here is the very last line of the bill, just that almost sneaks up on you by surprise, says that I almost lost it here. that you cannot call yourself a certified healthcare interpreter in the state of Oregon. Well, it happens to be the qualification that's granted by CCHI, the Certified Healthcare the Commission for Certified Healthcare Interpreters, which is one of the places that grants a certification as a prerequisite for being a certified interpreter in Oregon. Now, if we don't work as a team with the people who do the testing for interpreters in Oregon, we're in trouble. So there's two certification organizations on the national level, the National Board and and the CCHI. And so I've got a letter from them here where they submit a complaint to you on that issue. I'm going to turn that in to you when I'm done. We would recommend a very practical solution that followed the same pattern that they have for the courts. We submit that calling ourselves Oregon certified healthcare interpreters would clean this mess up nicely. So we're not just certified healthcare interpreters, we're just Oregon certified healthcare interpreters. Mm-hmm. And then that cleans the mess up nicely because Oregon has extra requirements beyond the national requirements. And then that follows the same pattern that's been established in the courts. And everything is, we're happy to work with the Oregon Health Authority on this and a few other little things that still need to be cleaned up. But we're happy with the work that's been done in the last week. We've really been able to work out a lot of just little details of cleanup, including this issue with the internship. They've been very, very helpful in the last week in cleaning up these things at the last minute.
We've got to ask you to introduce yourself. Could you do it now?
I did that at the start. I'm Helen Eby. I'm the president of the Oregon Health, Oregon Society of Translators and Interpreters.
Thank you.
I missed the name.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Next.
Thank you for hearing us on this bill. My name is Ana Ocampo. I am a national certified medical interpreter as well as Oregon certified medical interpreter. And we're here to support this bill on all the aspects that Helen already mentioned, and especially for the fact that interpreters are going to be included in council that is going to be in close contact with the Oregon Health Authority. That I believe is going to be a great improvement for our profession to be recognized as professionals. I've been doing this for more than 18 years, and I consider myself, you know, I'm already certified. I have the paper that shows it, but even before that, originally being a worker of the health system, I've always done my job professionally. And that's a respect that we don't always get. We do get a lot of satisfaction from this job, working with people and helping others break the language and cultural barriers between patients and the medical staff. But sometimes we do not get recognized, or we get disrespected, like in cases where if we're waiting for the appointment to happen or waiting for the patient to arrive, someone from that office may just come up and hand us a paper that needs to be translated and say, hey, I'll give you something to do here. You can do this while you wait, which is not within our scope to do. But I guess it's just lack of education in what we do or we're supposed to do. So the fact that we're going to be part of council and in close contact with the authority, it's a great progress, and we are happy for that reason. I know that OH authority, Oregon Health Authority, is not bound to listen to us, but the fact that we're going to be in close contact will help grow the profession and for us to also be recognized and more respected as in the work that we do. And thank you very much, the Chair, for hearing us.
Mr. Wolf, please. And for those of us that aren't too proficient in sign language, will you help us?
Yes.
Sorry for the false start. My name is Philip Wolf,
And I'm a commissioner with PCOD, the Portland Commission on Disabilities, up in Portland. And I had a personal experience where there was a barrier to access because an interpreter who was sent was not qualified. It was an emergency room, emergency department situation, and the agency they used to send interpreters, because those interpreters that they sent were not cheap, were not qualified because they were cheap. If they had used a different, more expensive agency, they would have had qualified interpreters for the situation that I was in. And so that was a barrier that I experienced personally. If I'm going to be in the emergency room, I want the best qualified interpreter there to provide access so that I can understand everything that's going on and they can understand me. And I appreciate this bill. I'm in support of this bill. One concern I do have, though, in one place it says, speaks of foreign language interpreters, and I want to make sure that it says it also includes American Sign Language interpreters. And so that's why I'm here, and I and the people I've come with are in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions at this panel? Thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
We have two more witnesses, I believe.
We do, Mr. Chair. C.M. Hall and Chad Ludwig.
It's my intention when we're finished with these witnesses to move into a work session for the purpose of adopting the Dash 2 amendments. And then we'll close the work session until we get the final wrap up. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Chad Ludwig. I'm the president for the Oregon Association for the Deaf. And we are the oldest association for the deaf and deafblind community here. We've been in existence since 1921. And we're in here to state that we support this amendment to the bill. We support the bill and the amendment adding the addition of the sign language interpreters, that they are qualified and certified to provide access and services to people who are deaf and deafblind in the medical settings. I also want to make a few other points. First is that we want to note that anytime a healthcare interpreter arrives at the scene, that they must be certified through the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf, which is commonly known as RID, and also that they have met Oregon standards for interpreter training and their Oregon's curriculum, which requires 60 hours of training minimum. So we want both of those pieces for our sign language interpreters. Another point that I'd like to make about healthcare interpreting in healthcare institutions is that often healthcare institutions contract with remote interpreters, commonly known as video remote interpreting, where the interpreter is on a computer screen. And that's a booming industry right now. And it can help fill some gaps when you can't get a live interpreter from the community at a location. Video remote interpreting is growing, but there are some problems with this segment of the industry. So we want for healthcare institutions to include in their contracts that interpreters that are interpreting through video remote interpreting also meet Oregon's state requirements for healthcare interpreters. And I think that's about all. You might remember in your readings in the Statesman Journal early last year where Salem Hospital faced a lot of issues with their provision and their support of deaf and hard of hearing patients. And these issues are not only happening at the Salem Hospital, but in healthcare institutions all over the state. And there are several actions currently in being taken against those institutions for providing interpreters who were not qualified, who could not get the job done in those healthcare settings in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is C.M. Hall, And I always like to add, especially when I'm speaking in front of a legislative body, that I'm a native Oregonian. I live in Southwest Portland, and I've been a sign language interpreter for 22 years. I am nationally certified by the body, Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf. I also serve on their National Association Board. The RID, the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf, are our national certifying body for sign language interpreters. I also coordinate a federal grant, a $1.5 million federal grant that's awarded to Western Oregon University. We cover 8 Western states and work on interpreter standards and effective practices in sign language interpreter education. So I also want to mention that along with Chad Ludwig, my colleague, we both serve on the Oregon Deaf and Hard of Hearing Advisory Committee for the state of Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2419 because I have heard all this, so many stories of poor access, unqualified access to healthcare settings here in Oregon, but unfortunately not just in Oregon. This is a problem nationwide. My colleagues at the Registry of the Interpreters for the Deaf organization are working with professionals who teach about interpreter education related to healthcare settings, and we are working on a national accreditation for healthcare interpreting within our interpreting body of sign language interpreters. Presently, there's a legal certification. There's also a generalist certification, but we are, in the next few years, working to have a healthcare interpreter designation. Oregon would be a leader, like the state of Washington, Oregon would be a leader if we were able to adopt this provision to have qualified and trained, certified sign language interpreters in the this House Bill 2419 added into it. I will say that. Just to tell you a little bit about my background, I don't actually work in healthcare settings. It's not my. It was my time up. Oh, it is. Well, I don't work in healthcare settings, but I know not to after 22 years, and I'm afraid of the folks that would work in healthcare settings that aren't qualified, and that's why we want to see this passed. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions in the panel? Thank you very much.
And before you move into a work session, I want to acknowledge that we just received written testimony only from Heidi Astrid Schmaltz. That will be submitted to the record in support of the bill.
I close a public hearing on House Bill 2419 and open a work session on House Bill 2419. Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlick, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 2415.
President Hayden moves that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2419. Commissioners will adopt these amendments and then close the if we adopt these and then close the work session and reopen it as soon as possible with the final set of amendments. Is there any discussion on the Dash 2 amendments? Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say for the record, Mr. Ludwig's testimony there was helpful. Thank you very much. I work routinely in a hospital setting where we use interpreters through video conferencing. And both for language and sign language included. And I think some of that information that we're being presented there would be helpful to get into the discussion here, along with some of the things that we're working on with telemedicine to make it smoother for the patients to communicate with the surgeons in that setting. So I applaud that testimony. Thank you.
Any further discussion? No.
On LEP.gov?
I'm sorry, we can't.
Oh, sorry.
We're in a work session. Would you please call the roll on the amendment?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Excuse.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Dyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. Motion carries. Dash 2 is a part of 2419. And I close the work session on 2419 and hope we'll have it back before us pretty soon. I'm going to open a public hearing Is there anybody here on the nail care?
I believe so. I haven't seen it.
I don't see these for a second.
The nail care, 2587.
I don't see Representative Barnhart.
Right, but we have, I think we have the sponsor of the bill here.
Oh, okay. He's chairing revenue right now.
So we have two people.
Maybe has something to do, huh?
Well, open up a public hearing on House Bill 2587, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's what we have.
House Bill 2587 defines natural nail care, specifies that an individual certified to practice nail technology is authorized to practice natural nail care. Whoa. Adds natural nail care to the Board of Cosmetology, which is located in the Health Licensing Office, and the Higher Education Coordinating Council sets education requirements. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. This is scheduled for a possible work session. We do have a fiscal impact statement and a no revenue impact statement. The fiscal statement reflects that at this time, both the Health Licensing Office and the Department of Education, or the Education Coordinating Commission, it's indeterminate if there is a substantial impact.
Please call the first panel. The only panel.
The only panel. Shannon Poole and Michael Snook. Oh, he's actually against it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Snook is against it. She's for it. Mm-hmm. I know. Well, if that's a... She doesn't necessarily want to go with the opposition, but you're the sponsor.
Do you want to explain the bill to us?
He can go first if he wants.
I prefer you go first, please.
Okay, should I go first?
Yes.
Okay. Papers out.
Good afternoon. My name is Shannon Poole. I'm from Eugene, and I'm the founder of HB 2587, the Natural Nails Bill. The purpose of this bill is to create a natural nails certificate through Oregon Health Licensing Agency, or OLA for short. Current law stipulates that all cosmetology students complete both natural nail care, such as manicures and pedicures, along with sculpted artificial nails, which alter the structure of the natural nail plate in order to create length or adornment. Here's a little bit of background. OLA governs cosmetology schools. They carry out the final testing. They issue certificates for workers in salons and spas or independents. There are three categories: hair, skin, nails. Hair has three certificates: barbering, then there's hairstylist. They do chemical services like perms or color, which alter the chemical structure of the hair. And there's also a third, natural, which allows braids or cornrows. Skin has a regular esthetician certificate, and there are also medical estheticians who work for doctors, altering the structure of the skin. They might be doing services like chemical peels or laser. I've maintained my certificate in the state of Oregon as an esthetician for 35 years, although I later went on to obtain degrees in family therapy and education. I returned to skincare 14 years ago. In 2012, I decided to get a nail certificate in order to expand my services. I experienced adverse allergic reactions to the hazardous chemicals, the liquids, the powders used in artificial nails, and I tried to opt out of that portion using OLA's accommodation form. I had it signed by an MD. My form was discarded by OLA, and I was told that it was mainly for learning disabilities or language issues. I had checked the box on the back, other. I spent about a year going around in circles between my school, OLA, and the Department of Ed, to avoid being further exposed to toxic chemicals like ethyl methacrylate, which is governed by the EPA. It's illegal to pour it down the drain. These chemicals are so volatile that the liquids and powders to make artificial nails can't be stored any closer than 12 inches from each other. In one phone call, an administrator at the Department of Ed said, if I didn't want to breathe toxic vapors, then I shouldn't have signed up for nails. I couldn't know ahead of time how I'd react. Perhaps my body is more chemically sensitive as a cancer survivor. That mindset seems outdated. It reminds me of secondhand smoke. If you don't want to breathe it, then don't become a waiter. Don't go out to a restaurant for dinner. In the end, I reached out to the heads of OLA and the Department of Ed, but they were unresponsive. In the end, I contacted my state representative, something I've never done, Mr. Phil Barnhart, but he didn't make progress either. It would take a legislative bill to make change. So my proposal is to separate natural nails and artificial nails into two categories at OLA, just like hair and skin. Enforcement would work just as it does with natural hair and skin, and all students would take the manicure, pedicure segments for basic nail health. The curriculum would not change, except that artificial nails would continue on with the full 600 hours. I really don't believe that vocational schools will lose out on money if natural nails paid a little bit less. I know a lot of folks in hair and skin who would add natural nails in order to offer simple hand and nail care while hair color was on, for example, or a facial mask was on, processing on a client. It would be a great add-on service for time-conscious clients. It would reduce downtime. It would add some extra income for the salon or for the worker. So along this journey, someone said, but you're not a lobbyist. In fact, you're nobody. Well, I'm just somebody asking for your support today to make a simple but profound change in law at OLA. Let the thousands of future students over the next 35 years choose between artificial sculpted nails like this and natural nail health. I thank you for your time and interest in this issue.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Yes, sir. My name is Mike Snook. I'm a co-owner of Academy of Hair Design here in town. And I understand the situation that she's talking about as far as maybe having sensitivities to some of the products that are involved in the acrylic nails. One thing, I believe that this could be handled administratively because in the law it basically says that it's artificial nails. It doesn't specifically say what kind of artificial nails. There are the ones that she's talking about, which involve monomers and tend to be more caustic. But you also have wraps, which are a fiberglass product that is put on the nails. And you also have gels, which is more common these days than they used to be. One of the issues I saw in this bill is that it says that that the natural nail technician will be able to use gel polishes. Well, gel polishes and gel nails are exactly the same thing. It's just the gel polish has color in it. You know, it uses the same process most of them use the same process to cure. So I believe that administratively, when I look at the only requirement that you use an acrylic product is when you look at the transcripts, it says acrylic nail forms. Everything else just speaks of artificial nails. And so I believe there are workarounds. If you have sensitivities to certain products, there are other products that are available. So if that's the gist of this bill, that it's because of the caustic chemicals that some use. I will tell you that in my school, I've never had an issue with that ever. I've talked to other schools that have had some issues, and generally they're able to handle that through the use of gloves and masks. But that being said, there are other options. And so the only issue that would come up as far as not being able to use or not being able to avoid that product in itself is the point where it says acrylic nail forms. And that could be done else, you know, in a different way. So I don't believe that you really need to do a bill. What happens when you do these types of things is you would not have 600 hours because it's very specific as to what hours are being geared for each thing. You know, and basically you're losing 145 hours. So you're looking at the program going down to 455 total hours now. Difference of about 3 weeks at the most. But what happens when you do that is that it affects things like financial aid. The program no longer qualifies for financial aid. It requires a lot of certification through each school to be able to teach those classes. It changes a lot more than what it appears for something that most nail technologists, that is the bread and butter of their business.
Thank you. Can I ask a representative from the Health Licensing Agency to join us?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm the Director of the Health Licensing Office. First of all, I would like to apologize if we did not respond in an appropriate manner to the bill proponent. When we looked at this bill, what we were concerned about is it does impact the curriculum of the schools, and I think what we had suggested to the proponent is that it truly is a school decision. We work very closely with the Higher Education Coordinating Council and their private career school department in terms of building the curriculum. We do test at the Health Licensing Office. If this bill went through, we would need to devise another state-administered test. We would like to continue to work on this and maybe come up with some solutions that would help the situation. We also cannot tell Representative Greenlick how deep this problem is. We did not have numbers of specific people or numbers of impact. So maybe we should do some assessment and find out if this is a widespread problem and if there's an administrative way to fix it. So, but again, my apologies from our office to you if you did not feel that we were responsive. So,
I'd very much appreciate if you would take a look at this and see if there's an administrative way to deal with it. A lot better than passing the law.
Yes, we will.
Although we love to pass laws, but
I know.
If we could do one less, it would be good. So we'll hear from you again.
Thank you.
You got a couple questions.
Okay. Yeah, let's go.
Holly, I appreciate you, and you've helped me out a lot on a lot of different issues and done a great job for us. I would be kind of curious to see if we've even seen this before, because obviously I think it looks like we have two people here for this, so unless there's a bunch more sitting back there, but I think that's
This is it.
Yeah. So, I mean, just find out, let us know if it's anything that's ever came up before, because I know the other end of females that go and get the pedicures and manicures, maybe someday I might try it if Representative Noss goes with me.
Can I ask my question? Can I make a comment before you?
I think you've earned that today.
I have. So I've never had a pedicure or a manicure either, but I'll totally take you up on that if you want.
I have had a manicure. I like it. Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair. Can you help me understand why we need to license natural nail care in the first place?
Representative Greenlick and members of the committee, Representative Bueller. That is actually one of our questions. We have several fields of practice within cosmetology, And what we would want to look at is assessing the need for another field of practice. So I think that might be some work that we could do. We really do not have a right now the numbers to do even a fiscal on this, to figure out what would be the licensure, what would be the numbers. So
could you comment to the broader issue that I think Representative Yeah. using? I mean, why do we regulate cosmetology, period? Yeah. I think that gets closer.
Or just nail care. I mean, I understand if you're using acrylics and a lot of volatile chemicals, but just natural nail care, why does that even need to be licensed?
You mean, could somebody just go ahead and do that?
Yeah.
So, actually, I would defer to Mike on this because it's a curriculum.
Basically, yeah. You know, it actually, a lot of people think that.
Say your name again, please.
Oh, my name is Mike Snook from Academy of Hair Design, Salem. One of the chemicals that has drawn more attention lately is formaldehyde, which is in the nail polishes. And so, you know, you have to understand how that works, and in fact, they've got new pure air purification requirements within that area. But what you have to learn is that, and the fact that when you're doing a pedicure, there are certain things that you have to know, and as far as sanitation processes, to make sure that your customers are safe. They've had some very bad results from people that were not trained properly, including losing limbs. It seems kind of, you wouldn't think that would be an issue, but it is.
Because makes some business for you.
Yeah. Back my question.
He's a surgeon.
I might have used nail polish once or twice without certification. Too.
But those are.
You should see his toenails.
For instance, if
it's
a
tattoo.
If somebody has shaved their legs, they're not supposed to get a pedicure that day, because you've exposed your skin. And there are a lot of germs in those petty spas that can infect or affect the person.
But okay, I'm not going.
But people do nail care.
Hey guys, we're going to go to a license.
People do nail care at home on themselves all the time.
They're exposing themselves to their own environment. When you go to a salon, you're exposing yourself to everybody else that's been in that same environment.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yeah, let's wrap this one up.
Oh, okay, never mind.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying, it reminds me, it's the difference between having someone at your house cut your hair, right, versus going to a barber or hairstylist, right? Like, if I'm paying somebody in the community, I want to have some assurance that, I'm going to get out of there with a mostly decent haircut, which I'm getting on Saturday, by the way, and I'm sure they're licensed.
You want us to vote on it on Monday?
Yeah, let's do that.
I'm going to close this work session. We'll hear back from you, Holly. I'm going to close this public hearing. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2294. What do we have here, Madam Administrator?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this requires the health authority to establish the Oregon Health Information Technology Program. It authorizes the authority to provide optional health information technology services to support statewide health care, establish fees to cover costs of expanding the HIT services. And we have folks here, the first panel.
And we have a bill ready to move if we decide to today, is that right?
We do not.
We do not, okay.
We do not.
So this will just be a public hearing?
Correct.
Everybody who signed up is in favor of the bill, so you don't have to belabor the point. Correct. And would you call the first panel?
Thank you. Susan Otter, Greg Van Pelt, Zeke Smith.
That's enough. This is high quality. We don't need too much quantity. Mm-hmm.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm pleased to present testimony today in support of this bill. I have submitted a written testimony, a two-pager, and a section-by-section as well, and all three of those items are available on OLIS. I'd like to talk a little bit about what health information technology is, so we're all talking about the same thing, and talk about some of our state efforts and how this bill updates our original legislation that was part of 2009 and House Bill 2009. When we talk about health information technology, we're talking about technology systems, software, and tools to for capturing, storing, sharing, and analyzing electronic health information. So we're thinking about clinical information in electronic health records. I'm thinking about electronic methods for sharing information across providers and coordinating care, analytic tools for assessing outcomes and performance and quality, and electronic tools and applications for patients to better manage their own health care through engagement with their own health information. These types of tools are critical to support our new models of coordinated care, accountability, and paying for outcomes. Our Medicaid coordinated care organizations recognize the need for health information technology tools, as do our hospitals, providers, and communities. The majority of our Medicaid CCOs use some of their Transformation Fund grants that were awarded in 2013 to invest in health information technology tools for their organizations or their communities. House Bill 2294 updates the Oregon Health Authority's current health information technology statute. Our current statute was put into place in House Bill 2009. That was, as you know, adopted in 2009. House Bill 2009 set forth the Health Information Technology Oversight Council, or HITOC, as we like our acronyms. That set forth a role for the Oregon Health Authority as a strategic policy and coordination role and established our strategic and planning body, the HITOC. House Bill 2294 updates that statute to account for a number of significant developments that have been underway since 2009. And I'll highlight three of those, which parallel the sections of the major sections of the bill. The first thing that's happened since 2009 is we have significant health information technology efforts underway within the Oregon Health Authority, funded by significant new federal funding. In 2013, we worked with a broad group of stakeholders to identify the right set of health information technology tools that were needed at the statewide level to support our new models of care coordination, accountability, and paying for outcomes. That strategic planning process updated the strategic plan we'd done before and identified specific services that were important to implement at the state level. We've worked with our CCOs and CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to achieve funding for that set of services to implement those services for the Medicaid program. Legislation is needed to ensure that we can provide those services to all Oregon healthcare entities and stakeholders statewide, not just for the Medicaid program, and to ensure the sustainability for those services. The second area that's been developing is partnerships and collaboratives that have developed organically across our healthcare stakeholders. Greg Van Pelt is here today to talk about one such partnership, and I'll let him focus on that area. Legislation is needed to enable the Oregon Health Authority the flexibility and clear authority to participate in those partnerships and collaborative efforts as they come up. The idea is, as our stakeholders come together to institute new health information technology projects or services, we can bring the Medicaid funding, the appropriate state perspective, and ensure that the Medicaid perspective is represented. And we need legislation to be able to formally participate in those efforts and vote on those governing boards, for example. And then third, the HITOC, our Health IT Oversight Council, which has been in place since 2009, has sought clarity about the role that they play in overseeing health information technology in light of the Oregon Health Policy Board. Legislation is needed to pull the HITOC officially under the Health Policy Board and to ensure alignment across those efforts. I'd like to mention a couple things that House Bill 2294 does to address these three areas. First, House Bill 2294 requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish the Oregon Health Information Technology Program. This program would encompass work that's already in place or underway within the Oregon Health Authority. It provides clear authority to OHA to be able to operate these services in the program to provide to serve our stakeholders across the state, as I mentioned, not just for the Medicaid program, and sets the goals of the program in line with the goals of our coordinated care organizations and health system transformation. The bill also describes some of the activities that we can engage in to support the Oregon Health IT program, such as charging fees, seeking accreditation, et cetera. The bill does not require the Oregon Health Authority to establish any particular health information technology services. Instead, it clarifies that the services that we do provide may be provided broadly, and it gives us the ability to sustain those services. The second area that House Bill 2294 addresses, as I mentioned, is the ability for Oregon Health Authority to engage in partnerships and collaboratives and enter into agreements with respect to participation in funding, participation in formal governance roles to represent the interests of the state when other stakeholders have come together to institute health information technology. And lastly, the bill pulls the HITECH under the Health Policy Board, has the Health Policy Board establish the members of the committee of the council, and to ensure reporting up to the Health Policy Board on how we're doing as a state in health information technology, what barriers we are facing, and how we ought to move forward. And Zeke Smith is here from the Health Policy Board to touch a bit about that. I'll just close by saying that the Oregon Health Authority is bringing forth an amendment to tighten the language of the bill a little bit and to ensure that the Oregon Health Authority is required to report to the legislature on the activities of the Oregon Health IT program, which was not in the original bill. We don't have that amendment drafted yet, but we have put that in. In closing, I'll say that the field of health information technology is constantly evolving, and it's challenging. The tools that health information technology brings is critical to our success in achieving health system transformation in Oregon. Together, the Oregon Health Information Technology Program and the HITECH can ensure that our stakeholders have the right technology tools, information, guidance, and a forum for defining our strategies, policies, measuring our progress, and ensuring transparency to support and promote the effective use of health information technology across Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Appel, are you next? Mr. Smith?
Thank you. I think I'll go next speak. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, and members of the committee. It's good to see all of you. Good afternoon. My name is Greg Van Pelt, President of the Oregon Health Leadership Council. The Leadership Council is a membership organization in partnership with the Oregon Business Council and 31 Oregon healthcare organizations, including all major health systems, commercial health plans, coordinated care organizations, medical groups, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and the Oregon Medical Association. Though we have many important relationships with the Oregon Health Authority, I'll focus on the type of work that we are doing and how this legislation enables us to do more in a public-private partnership that really is essential to truly transform healthcare. The Emergency Department Information Exchange is a web-based communication technology that allows emergency departments to communicate about patient visits in real time. We know that inappropriate use of emergency departments is a significant driver of avoidable healthcare costs. The technology allows emergency department clinicians to identify patients with complex care needs who frequently use the emergency room for their care and who would be better served in a different setting. So when a patient visits an emergency department, that patient's information is automatically sent to the EDI, Emergency Department Information Exchange Repository, through an interface with hospital's electronic medical record. A notification summary of that patient's history and other care guidelines is sent back to the hospital immediately by EDI application if the patient has visited an ED, or emergency department, five or more times in the last 12 months, or has visited more than three different emergency departments in the last 2 months. Real-time notifications are also sent to patients' treating physicians as requested. As of today, all but three Oregon hospitals are operational, sending outbound data to the Emergency Department Information Exchange System and receiving emergency department notifications. We have aligned these metrics with the health authority, the CCOs, and the hospitals. So all of us are working on the same metrics and using this technology to align the work that we're doing. The utility, or the Emergency Department Information Exchange, provides a common infrastructure that provides value across the entire care system. We will interchangeably use the word utility because it's being financed now by 11 commercial health plans, the Oregon Health Authority on behalf of all the 16 CCOs and 55 hospitals throughout the state. The statewide effort was made possible through the partnership of the Leadership Council, our members, the Oregon Chapter of American College of Emergency Physicians, and the leadership of the Health Authority's Office of Information Technology. The Health Authority's partnership was critical in launching the first phase of the effort, providing leadership, staff support, matching grant funding to obtain commitment of hospitals across Oregon. And as we moved into the utility concept and brought broad support across all stakeholders, the Health Authority led the coordination and outreach to all CCOs in the state to obtain their support. And then finally, the Health Authority obtained federal match grants to provide the Medicaid share of funding to sustain the information exchange for 3 years to prove its value. We also see this as the first of many future opportunities to work together. Now that we have, in so many words, established the utility, as our healthcare stakeholders continue to adopt risk-sharing relationships, it's going to be critical for them to rely on technology tools such as this information exchange to support critical transitions from hospital care to manage population health and coordinate care across the sectors of all healthcare. Thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you, and very much support this effort.
Always happy to see you, Mr. Van Pelt.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and other members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on House Bill 2294, and I promise that I will be brief. My name is Zeke Smith, and I currently have the pleasure of serving as the chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. The Health Policy Board takes seriously our role in transforming our system of care to ensure greater access to quality health care, reduced costs, and a healthy Oregon, particularly for those communities for whom the system has not worked well. Effective and up-to-date health information technology can accelerate the speed with which we begin to see these outcomes, playing a vital role in health system transformation and in the coordinated care model. With the right health technology tools, meaningful, timely, relevant, and actionable patient information can be made available to providers and consumers to deliver better coordinated whole-person care. The current bill affirms the board's intention to create greater alignment between the Health Information Technology Oversight Committee and other policy and accountability work overseen by the board. It includes things like CCO metrics and reporting, effective oversight of the Oregon Health Authority, and continued integration of mental health and public health systems with our coordinated care model. It also provides appropriate flexibility to align with the fast pace of change in the world of technology, supporting the Health Authority and the HIT Oversight Committee in their capacity to bring the right technology solutions to our system of care. Lastly, I want to acknowledge the requirement of HB 2294 that the board will, quote, ensure broad representation on HITOC of individuals and organizations that will be impacted by, end quote, OHA's health IT efforts. As a board, we're committed to diverse consumer and stakeholder engagement. We would look to ensure representation from various perspectives, providers, hospitals, health plans and CCOs, consumer advocates, behavioral health advocates, from users of various electronic health record systems, ensuring that both Epic and non-Epic users would be represented, and from diverse regions of the state. We are in support of this bill, and we appreciate your time and energy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Welcome. Are there questions of this panel?
Quick question.
Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. As you develop these information systems, just want a background question for me, and you go out to contract with people to help you build that. What progress requirements are you going to have within those contracts so that you proceed in a timely manner with success? And how do we get that feedback?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, thank you for the question. As we proceed with any technology projects within the state, we are, of course, moving to deliverables-based contracting that have milestones, et cetera. We have significant oversight by the Department of Administrative Services of all technology projects that we have underway, and I'm sure they'd be happy to come talk to you further about their progress in that area.
And a follow-up question.
Go ahead.
Scanning through this, I can't swear it was this document. Is there in the information technology that you're absorbing into the Oregon Health Authority? I thought I read that there was a line in there about requiring
access to all the contractual agreements between the CCO's contractors back up to Oregon Health Plan, Oregon Health Authority. Do you not have that now, or have I just read too much information that that's not part of? Meaning, if the CCO contracts with a particular provider, you wanted to have access to that specific contract.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Hayden, I don't believe that that, I'm not familiar with the section that you're referring to, and I'm wondering if it's...
I was trying to find it, and I couldn't.
So. I'm not sure this panel. Is that from the original statute or in the amended?
We don't have
it yet, sir. No, okay. What I mean is in the original statute or is in this amended by this bill.
Got it.
Where they require that that is available?
Yeah. Is that a part of this bill, or is that a part of the
I'm not
existing?
Sure. That's what I was asking. She's saying it probably isn't part of this bill.
It's probably in the current
Chair Greenlake, Representative Hayden, I'd be happy to follow up with you afterwards, and we can make sure to coordinate. I'm not, I don't have that, any further information for you today.
Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And the next panel, you guys will share about 9 minutes.
Heidi Schwartz, Jeremy Vandehay, Jessica Adamson.
So you don't need 9 minutes.
So where, I don't know who this is.
6 minutes.
What's the name?
Is that me?
Is there somebody else signed up to testify that way?
From Clackamas County?
I bet it's the wrong bill.
Okay, maybe it's the wrong bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. For the record, Jeremy Vandy with Kaiser Permanente. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I was worried I'd be last standing between you and the weekend, which is why I dragged Jessica up here.
Oh, don't worry.
Take your time. Just take your time. Do it quickly.
We support this bill, and I'll tell you why. As an integrated system, Kaiser represents about 500,000 members in the Northwest. We were one of the first to launch our robust electronic health record system, and it's really at the core of our coordinated model. Not only does it link providers within our system, where somebody ends up in the primary care or emergency room or in for labs or in the pharmacy, but it also provides us a great amount of data and helps us really achieve the goals that transformation set out to do, to be able to track outcomes, be able to track our population and trends. So we totally support the efforts that the state is undertaking to promote similar goals in the rest of the state. There's three specific reasons we support this bill. First, it aligns the health IT goals with those of transformation. So not only just sharing medical records, but also improving outcomes, improving accountability and transparency, and promoting payment reform. It moves the body of work under the Oregon Health Policy Board, which we think is critical to ensure that it's aligned with the other efforts with the board's undertaking and that it's aligned around a strategic direction. And finally, it allows the state to be able to collaborate with work that's already occurring on the ground and charges. This is an important note, we think, is that it charges a user fee is how the funding would occur, which means we think it would put the state in a position to be able to supplement and build a partner with efforts that are already occurring because it'll be focused on efforts where there's a need and there's demand. Not necessarily where there's already work occurring. So we really support the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any present? Ms. Adamson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jessica Adamson here on behalf of Providence Health and Services, and I would echo the comments of my colleague, Mr. Vandehay, and just note that our COO, Theron Park, has submitted a letter also in support of this bill. We would note that the most important aspects that this bill provides is an opportunity for the health authority to help fill gaps. Many systems have adopted Epic. It's working great for large systems, but this represents an opportunity to help provide links for entities that don't have that, as opposed to trying to build duplicative systems, but how do we link systems that are already working together? And we think that is a real promise and important. Additionally, we look forward to an ongoing dialogue so that as that development occurs, it really does meet the needs of the market and is priced in a way that everyone can access it. So thank you again for the opportunity to speak in favor and happy to answer any questions.
I bet there are lots of questions for you. Seeing none,
thank you
very much for your testimony. I will close the public hearing. And what bill are we in? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2294. And wish you all Godspeed for a safe trip home. We're adjourned.
5 minutes.
I'm going to ship it to you and Susan.